I first heard of Reverend John E. Brooks, S.J., in late 2005, when I was a senior writer at Business Week. I was having lunch at a Midtown Manhattan restaurant with a PR executive named Eric Starkman and his client, Stan Grayson, a lawyer and former deputy mayor of New York who was then president of one of the country's few minority-owned investment banks, M.R. Beale & Company. It was really just a courtesy meeting. I rarely covered Wall Street, but I trusted Eric's judgment about people, and he said Grayson was a man I should take the time to meet. Over lunch, the three of us chatted about the economy, basketball, and how New York had changed since Grayson oversaw its finances during the 1980s. The conversation turned to Ted Wells, a lawyer who had been profiled in a New York Times article that week. Wells was representing Scooter Libby, the senior aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, who'd been charged with perjury and obstruction of justice for allegedly leaking the identity of CIA officer Valerie Plame to the media. It seemed natural that Libby would turn to Wells, who had a record of representing high-profile defendants, including junk bond king Michael Milken, former agricultural secretary Mike Espy, tobacco giant Philip Morris, and ExxonMobil, and who would later go on to represent Elliot Spitzer. The Times article had painted Wells as a formidable trial lawyer, one of the best in the country, who had been raised by a single mother in Washington, D.C., and attended college on a football scholarship. It turned out that Wells and Grayson had attended the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts together. Grayson recalled that Wells had shared a dorm room with Eddie Jenkins, who became a running back with the Miami Dolphins during the team's legendary 1972 perfect season, and went on to establish his own law practice before becoming chairman of the Massachusetts Alcoholic Beverages Control Commission. Down the hall from them, Grayson said, was the writer Edward P. Jones, who would later win a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and a Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Known World. Another hallmate was future Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. They had all arrived on campus in the fall of 1968. At a time when the civil rights of African Americans had taken on a new urgency amid the rise of the Black Power movement and the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. earlier that year in April. The passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act a year later had fostered both hope and frustration. Hope that Black Americans would finally experience the same rights and opportunities as everyone else, and frustration that the progress was so slow. One of the most obvious signs of inequality was the higher education system. While public schools had started to desegregate in the 1950s, many of the nation's top colleges remained bastions of white privilege well over a decade later. They had been slow to open their doors to Black students, and even slower to reach out to them with scholarships and support. Racial integration may have been a topic of debate on college campuses by 1968, but evidence of it was still in short supply. To have such an accomplished group of African-American men emerge from a small Irish Catholic college in central Massachusetts seemed both unusual and amazing. "Was there something in the water?" I joked. Grayson shook his head and said, "It was Father Brooks." He went on to describe a compassionate, if sometimes brusque, priest who mentored, defended, coached, and befriended the group of Black students who were at Holy Cross in the late 1960s. He'd personally had a hand in recruiting them to the school and had pushed to get the money for full scholarships at a time when many of his peers were unsure about whether to seek out minority students. He'd then nurtured them through their often challenging years at Holy Cross. When all of the Black students at the college had quit school in protest against alleged racism in 1969, Brooks had been the one to bring them back. When the students needed supplies, transportation, and a place where they could live together and create a community on the otherwise white campus, Brooks had come through with the money or authorization needed to make it happen. It was less the material support, though, than the knowledge that he believed in the young men and had their backs. Without Brooks, Grayson insisted, none of us would have made it. I asked Grayson when he had last been in touch with the priest, expecting to hear another anecdote from the early 1970s. The answer, a few weeks ago, surprised me. Since the men had graduated, Brooks had remained involved in their lives, standing up for Thomas in his bid for the Supreme Court, calling members of the group to celebrate accomplishments, presiding over weddings, and the occasional funeral. Decades after they had left the school, many of the men had continued to gather at Wells House for an annual barbecue. The college friends were godfathers to one another's children. Naturally, I was curious. In the months and years that followed, I met with Brooks and the men whose lives he had influenced. In addition to Wells, Thomas, Jones, Grayson, and Jenkins, other talented young black men mentored by Father Brooks had gone on to build successful careers in law, business, and other areas. One became a prominent physician who served on Air Force Two. Another spent two seasons in the NFL.